Welcome to Cryptic Soup. Tonight's case is Peter Curtin, also known as the Dusseldorf Vampire. Peter Curtin was a serial killer active in 1929 in Dusseldorf. His crime spree was horrific, with crimes that included arson, murder, sexual assault, robbery, breaking and entering, theft, and more. And with a name like that, you know there is some blood consumption going on somewhere. I'm Kylie.
And I'm Thina.
And tonight, we have a gruesome case to share with you.
I don't have anything to talk about that isn't the case tonight.
Well, I learned, okay, so I was training new hires at work, and we did more of like a classroom-based type of training for like 2 days. And so every day we made sure that people were really comfortable with each other. And so we did icebreakers every single day. And some of them were like icebreakers, and then some of them were like team building. So I have talked about our podcast and myself for like the past 4 days straight.
So, I love that for you.
Yeah. So I did learn, however, that my director listens to us. So there's that.
That's kind of exciting.
Yeah. What else we got? Can't think of anything.
Oh. Do you want to dive in then tonight?
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, tonight's case, Peter Curtin. So in case you don't know that much about it, this case does talk a lot about rape, sexual assault. There's mentions of incest, bestiality, pedophilia, and overall, it's just a pretty disgusting case about a monster. Literally, that's the only way to describe this man. And we understand that some people might not be able to do all that tonight, or maybe at all. So if you can't listen, we get it. But this is a listener request, and so we're going to try and tackle it. But it might be the darkest case we've done, in all honesty.
The darkest case, really.
Yeah. I think that Peter Curtin might be the biggest monster we have tackled. I'm trying to think of someone that is worse than him, and I don't think I can. He's horrific. He's genuinely horrific.
Have we even really done a serial killer?
Uh-huh.
The only one I can think of is like...
Well, we've done spree killers. Do you consider any spree killers as serial killers also, or do you want specific serial killers?
I guess like specific serial killers. I feel like we haven't done that.
The Gainesville Ripper was a serial killer.
Yep, that's the only one I'm thinking of, though.
The Santa of Covina was a serial killer. The Dayton Christmas Massacre was a spree killer. The St. Valentine's Day Massacre, technically. The Christopher Dunch is a serial killer. Belle Gunness is a serial killer that we covered.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about her. Whoopsies.
Joanne Dennehy was a spree killer, so I wouldn't count that one. And then I think we did one other spree killer that I'm not thinking of, and then Peter Curtin.
So not that many. So I'm not going crazy. Okay. I'm ready. I'm ready to learn.
You're ready? Okay. Peter Curtin was born May 26th in 1883.
That's not a real date.
This is a really old case.
it's not a real date.
He is a Gemini. That is also Stevie Nicks' birthday, and that's World Redhead Day.
Interesting.
He was born in Molheim Rain, it's a suburb of Cologne, Germany, and he was born into a really rough environment. Peter's family was already quite problematic. There were 13 children.
Wow.
And the entire family was super poverty stricken.
Would you stop at 13 children? Because I wouldn't.
You would keep going?
I would keep going. So I didn't have 13 children.
Oh, they don't have 13 children.
Oh.
They actually have two of the children pass away under a year old. So they only have 11 children.
Oh, I'm sorry. Only 11.
Okay, I was trying to make it better. I mean, it's not better because two children passed away, so that's really dark, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So still. They had 11 children, and actually Peter was the oldest, and they were living in a one-bedroom apartment, the family was.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even imagine what that looks like.
So the father, he was a severe alcoholic, and most of the money that he had, like almost all of his wages, would go towards alcohol. And that left really little money for food or other necessities for the rest of the family. For him, his father is also a bit of a mess. No, not a bit. His father is a mess. And this case specifically brings in a lot of nurture versus nature questions.
Mm.
And this case brings a lot of questions about like psychology and how you raise children. And just there's a lot of stuff in this case that you'll be like, this case shaped and paved the way for a lot of stuff you'll learn. The Curtin family had a lot of problems with dysfunctionality. Like I said, two of the children passed away. Also, since Peter was the eldest child, he was often the target for his father's harshest abuse, which was including mental, emotional, physical, and sexual abuse. Now, due to the fear of his father, he would try to avoid his home as much as possible. And when he gets a little bit older, like between his adolescent to like teen years, he'll run away a lot, sometimes for weeks on end.
I mean, I'm surprised he came back. I mean, really, like, what do you have to go back to?
He really didn't have anything, but you'll learn that he was kind of scared on his own, too, because he wasn't making it. Now, the children weren't the only people that were at the hands of Peter's father. So whenever he came home drunk, he would collect all the children and usually inflict a lot of abuse upon everyone. But then he would also make them all sit around and watch as he degraded, stripped, and raped their mother. So Peter realized that the only way he was going to make it was if he could, like, do things. Things like pickpocketing. So he was often caught pickpocketing for money to buy food or clothing. But since he was so young and, like, due to his age, they never really disciplined him much, and authorities kind of let him get away with it.
So if he came up to you and pickpocketed you, what would you do? Because I would be like, if I have, like, better means, I'd be like, do you need food? You know, like, I would help.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't just leave it at that. I think I would do more if I could.
Yeah, like, obviously you're desperate for things. Like, you don't want to do this, but, like, let me help you and let me get you some bread. Or, you know, like, I would help them in that sense. Even if I didn't have a lot of money, I would still.
This is the late 1800s, almost 1900s in Germany, though. So this isn't super far before the Great Depression and everything else. So there is a lot of problems already circulating the area. So that might be part of it, though. After growing up and seeing such violence around his home, Peter didn't feel very out of the norm reciprocating this, like, outward violence towards other people. And you'll see that, like, due to that upbringing, it kind of follows him around in life. In 1892, at the age of 9 years old, Peter committed his first murder. Peter and a school friend were hanging out in the river, and they made a log raft. And then Peter pushed his friend off the raft into the water, knowing that he couldn't swim. So then another boy on the, like, bank saw that the first boy was drowning, and he attempted to help out. So he got in the water and, like, chose to swim out and help. And at this point, Peter pushed and held both the boys' head underwater. In some stories, he pushed the raft on top of them, and in some stories, he just held them down. But in the end, both boys ended up drowning. Peter was later found alone that day at the river on the raft, and he was crying and he was upset. And the authorities were like, what happened? And he told them, and they ruled the deaths as accidental.
So until you were like, he held the boys underwater, I was like, well, that's not really, like, I mean, boys, that's like a bullying gone wrong, or like a
boys playing
could end in exactly something. Like, yeah. Boys playing, and it went wrong. But
Peter claimed that learning that he got away with this whole fiasco kind of taught him something. He said that he elicited the proper response to get him away with the crime, because, like, by crying and being sad, he got away with murder, essentially, because he played a part, and so he got away with it. In 1894, the family relocated to Dusseldorf, and the patterns of abuse didn't end there. By 1897, Peter's father went to jail. Some things say for 18 months, some say up to 3 years. And he went to jail for repeatedly raping his eldest daughter, who was 13 years old. Now, without having a father there to provide for the family, they were worse off than ever. There's something I did not mention. Another thing that happened at 9 years old, right before they moved to Dusseldorf, something else happened in Peter's childhood that was a really big deal. He befriended one of their neighbors, which was a local dog catcher, and he lived next door, and Peter began accompanying him for work. Here's the thing. This guy was known for torturing and killing the animals and practicing bestiality on the dog corpses. So he taught Peter to do that same stuff.
And he's nine.
The theme of bestiality will also come up more in Peter's life, along with this brutality, obviously. And because we don't talk about bestiality, I almost said enough. Often, that's the word I'm looking for here.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to look up some bestiality facts real quick for you.
Okay.
Did you know, according to a study by psychologists at the University of Tennessee, adolescents who engage in bestiality are far more likely to commit rape and murder as adults?
Interesting.
Did you know, also, only 31 states in the U.S. have laws specifically about not having sexual acts between human and animals? 16 of them consider it a felony and 15 of them consider it a misdemeanor. The most common animals that these acts occur on are horses, snakes, dogs, and cows.
I'm sorry. Snakes?
Yes. And did you know the two most common are dogs and cows, actually?
I could gather that. I would think that horses would also be up there. But snakes?
Mm-hmm.
How?
Do you really want to know?
I kind of do, yeah. I really do kind of want to know. I don't know how you're going to cut all of that, but or how it, yep, but you do you.
Hey guys, we're back. I just had to teach Kylie some really fucked up things about bestiality, but we're back now. The more you know, in a really gross way.
Yep.
I'm so sorry, everyone, for teaching you things tonight. Mostly myself for talking about it. Moving on. Peter would often run away from home and avoid it as much as possible, like I said earlier. He would be gone from days or weeks at a time. Sometimes he would be living out in the forest, or sometimes he would relocate himself to be living on the streets or near anyone who would take him in. This often meant Peter was also near a lot of other homeless criminals who would be willing to, like, live with him, near him, things like that. And these people would teach him the ways of their petty crimes, which meant that Peter was learning how to steal things correctly, just to stay afloat. And eventually that is what makes him want to, like, continue stealing and almost get better at it. That's another thing about Peter, is once he learns something, he kind of just wants to keep getting better at it. And that's a really scary thing, because he learns some really fucked up stuff.
It's like, you are who you are around.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? You are who you associate with.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's only associating with bad people like that. And so he's honing in on those skills.
In his early teens, Peter amps up, like, the things he's doing quite fast through his sexual deviancy before he starts getting into complete perversion and murder. So he got a girlfriend at a young age, as a young teen. And once he gets this girlfriend, he kind of, you know, hints at her that he wants to be sexually active. And they did stuff. They made out. They would fondle, things like that. But she resisted having actual sex with him, even though he tried multiple times and made the attempt. Peter didn't really like that she would kind of brush him off and not do that, because he had a really high sex drive, and he said he was trying to control his urges by having sex with his girlfriend. So in attempts to find a new way to control his urges, he started engaging in bestiality again. He was having sexual encounters with local sheep, pigs, and goats in nearby stables. Initially, he said he was trying to have sex with one of the sheep one night, but it wouldn't work out in his favor, so he got angry and he stabbed the animal, which elicited a new response for Peter, and it met the craving that he was looking for sexually. So from that point on, not only was Peter actually engaging in bestiality, but he admitted that his greatest sense of climax came from a mixture of sex and stabbing the animal before reaching his orgasm. So this led to Peter regularly cutting, stabbing, and harming the animals as he was engaging them sexually. That was until someone supposedly had caught him doing this with a pig. And Peter said that he was going to quit this entire thing that he was doing because maybe it was wrong.
How old is he at this point?
Still in his teens. He's under 16.
Okay.
However, later Peter does admit during his trials that there were some other things he did as a teen that were also really grotesque. Some of the things included, he once broke a squirrel's neck just for fun. He once saw an injured horse bleeding out and he ejaculated to that. He once cut off a swan's head and drank its blood and orgasmed during that act. And the animals weren't the only ones who were at the mercy of Peter's horrors at this point. Quickly after learning about his gratification from animals, he moved on to humans by attempting to rape the same sister that his father previously went to jail for raping.
That's interesting, because normally you're like you have a different feeling about, like, family.
you should very much.
Yeah, normally, you know.
Especially because he hated his father so much. Why would he want to be like him?
That's what I mean. Like, if he hated him so much, then why is he becoming him?
Kind of odd to me that he didn't. Not that I want this to happen. I'm surprised that his next reaction wasn't, I should try stabbing and raping my girlfriend instead of I should try raping my sister. You know what
no,
I mean?
No, for real. No, that's where I thought that was going. So.
It sounds like that's where that would have went in my head.
Yep. Me too.
In 1898, Peter's father was released from jail and Peter ended up dropping out / leaving school at this point. His father started pushing him towards getting an apprenticeship instead. So Peter ended up finding one as a molder at 16 years old. And that apprenticeship lasted for almost 2 years before Peter stole all of his employer's money and ran away.
All of it.
Yeah. It was like 300 marks and he stole it and ran away. He broke into the house and stole it. Peter was caught 4 days later after running away to Koblenz, where he struck up a new relationship with a prostitute. Peter was charged with both breaking and entering and theft, and he was subsequently sentenced to 1 month in jail for his crimes. You'll also notice a really big trend in this whole case is that, like, the time in prison that you get for crimes back in the 1800s and 1900s is vastly different than what you would get nowadays. Oh, yeah, it's
insane.
You're going to learn they just throw you in for like a day. They'll be like, oh, you murdered someone, you get a week. You raped someone, 73 hours. Like, they just spin a wheel and pick a random number. It seems like they literally had not that very many rules. Peter ended up then going from starting a life of small crimes to a life of pure crime that could land him in and out of imprisonment for the rest of his life after this, because this was like the first time he really went to jail and it kind of just sealed the deal for him. Peter was released from prison in August of 1899. We're almost to the 1900s. Look at us go.
Crazy. We've made
still seems so far away.
I know.
A lot of the facts and information about any case you hear about Peter Curtin comes from his own personal accounts, because he told investigators and confessions about his life years later, but it was all seen as evidence and facts due to the timeline of the events. So Peter claimed in November that year that he actually did pick up an 18-year-old girl and asked her to accompany him, where he later engaged in sex with her before strangling her and leaving her for dead. However, unlike a lot of the other parts of this case, this body was never found, and authorities believe that either the victim was not dead or this part of the story wasn't true. But then a year after that event, in 1900, Peter did get arrested again. This time it was for fraud, and over the next 4 years, he would be in and out of prison for numerous crimes, mostly being like petty theft. Because it almost seemed like once he got out of prison that first time, he almost just couldn't stay afloat, because he obviously went to prison during his apprenticeship, so he couldn't get another job like that. He didn't end up finishing school. He couldn't fall back on his family. It's almost like he kind of got stuck in a rut. So he was just continuing this small cycle and it just kept landing him back in and out of prison.
There's just like nowhere else he could go.
Mm-hmm. Once 1904 rolled around, Peter was drafted in the Imperial German Army and deployed to serve in the 98th Infantry Regiment. But unlike what you would normally hear, where they like became a sick sadistic monster because of their PTSD, Peter instead just deserts and bails on it. He never even goes to the war.
It's like, nah, don't feel like this.
He's like, that's not for me. But that will come back to bite him in the ass. But when he comes back, he actually invokes a lot of havoc and commits a bunch more crimes instead of going to be in the army. So Peter begins this new fascination when he comes home with arson. And he starts to set local barns on fire. He was eventually caught and arrested, but he admitted to authorities that he partook in at least 24 acts of arson. And his end goal was to hopefully burn someone alive that was maybe harboring inside of a barn. Okay. But there was probably animals inside those.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So like, he probably was getting some sort of gratification in a different way because he liked seeing things get tortured.
Maybe.
Being caught by authorities from the arsons meant that Peter had to address the fact that he also deserted his position in the barracks in the military. So Peter was tried by military court. Which nowadays is a very big deal, as Kylie can say.
Yep.
Not as big of a deal back then.
No.
He was convicted of desertion.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yep.
He was convicted of desertion in addition to multiple counts of arson, robbery, and attempted robbery. And as a result, he was imprisoned from 1905 to 1913 in Munster. So only 8 years for all that. While imprisoned, Peter spent most of his time in solitary confinement, usually for insubordination, and he received forms of corporal punishment while there. He doesn't talk a lot about his time in prison, but he said it really turned him into the type of person he was, because after that, it changed him into this type of person because he was dedicated to revenge and killing people due to how he was treated in there. This will later come up in investigations because Peter says not only was he physically reprimanded in the prison, but this is where his erotic fantasies started to really form after he did experience corporal punishment. Once he was released, there was no cool down period for Peter. He instantly resumed the life of theft again. Peter said surviving outside the prison life was difficult and he couldn't afford to survive on his own. So again, he took up stealing to survive. Like I said, he was back in that cycle. On May 25th, 1913, Peter attempted to rob a tavern, but instead, while he was there, he came across a 9-year-old girl named Christine Klein who was asleep in her bed. Supposedly, while being afraid to leave survivors, plus overwhelmed with the ideas at his disposal that he had just developed in prison, he decided to act on them. He strangled Christine and slashed her throat twice with a pocket knife that he happened to have on him, while her parents were working in the tavern just below her room. As Christine started to bleed onto the floor and bedding that she was still laying in, Peter ejaculated and orgasmed at the sight and sound of her blood hitting the floor in front of him. And then he left.
Don't like that.
The following day, Peter returned to the same area to drink in a tavern located directly across the street from where he committed the previous night's act, just so he could listen in on the locals' reaction to the child's murder and find some sort of gratification in the repulsion that they had for it. If that wasn't enough, in the next few weeks, Peter actually continued to travel back and forth from where he was staying to the town where Christine was buried, just to continue to visit her gravesite where he would ejaculate on it. Also during this time, Christine's uncle, Otto, was framed for the murder because the night before he had a huge fight with the family. Christine's father and Otto, the uncle, got into a huge fight and Otto had said something about like, if you don't stop, I'm going to do something that we'll both end up regretting for the rest of our life or something like that. And he made like a vague threat. Well, of course, Christine's father had that threat happen. And then the next night, his daughter is murdered. So Otto ends up getting sent to jail. But later, at least, he is released when authorities realize he could not have been the killer. However, Otto lived in that town where everyone thought he was the killer for like ever, pretty much. It wasn't until over 10 years later when Peter finally gets caught that people finally realized Otto wasn't the person that murdered his niece. After Christine's attack, Peter's ramp up phase did not slow down. In fact, he did a bunch of small assault attacks, leaving a lot of victims living but maimed. In June of 1913, Peter attacks a 20-year-old woman by smacking her in the back of the head with the dull end of a hatchet after following her home. And then he just runs away after attacking her.
I like how you're like the dull end of a hatchet. That still would fucking hurt.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Well, it's because the next person he walks up to, a month later, he goes up to a man in the park who's sitting on the bench and he hits him with the sharp end of the hatchet.
Got it. Yep. So the first part was the first step. And then the hatchet was the second.
I had to say it like that. Yeah. So he hits this man with the sharp end of the hatchet in the head. And then Peter actually hid in a bush and started ejaculating while watching the man bleeding. Both these people live and survive, but Peter was super excited by the thought of hurting these people. And then Peter was still regularly committing arson and theft also.
So on top of everything, he's still being a shithead.
And who knows if he's still committing bestiality, in all honesty, we don't know.
Probably was.
Probably was, knowing him.
Well, I'm assuming that he's doing those things before the arson because he was like doing that to barns and things. So I'm assuming that he's just like going rampant. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then being like, oh, well, I'm just going to burn it down.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
In July of that same year, Peter burglarized another building. And this time he came across a skeleton key. With the help of this key, Peter broke into a home in Dusseldorf. Once inside, Peter crept around the house till he found Gertrude Franken asleep in her bed. She was a 17-year-old girl. Peter then strangled Gertrude, squeezing her throat so tightly he damaged her vocal cords. She never even had a chance to scream for help. When he saw the blood coming from her mouth, like gurgling out, he ejaculated at the sight of it. Since Peter still got his sexual gratification from Gertrude without having to slit her throat, unlike Christine, because he saw it, you know, pouring out of her mouth, Peter just assumed Gertrude was dying or dead. So he then locked the front door behind him and left. However, Gertrude was not dead. She was just really badly hurt. On July 14th, his crime spree had finally started catching up with him. He was arrested for the series of arson attacks and burglaries. Not for anything else, though. He was originally sentenced for 6 years of imprisonment, but it gets extended to 8 years, so he gets an additional 2 years, and that was again for insubordination while he was in prison. Peter was sent to the military prison at Bjerg and Penitentiary, where he would often brag about his violent and sexual conquests while describing them in graphic details. He also would socialize with other sexual or violent offenders and exchange advice on how to get away with crimes and behavior that they should admit during trials to, like, get away with things.
Love that. Just love that.
How this isn't, like, the biggest red flag.
Right.
Like, to not let him out again is beyond me.
Right.
In April of 19... This man has a million chances. I will just say that.
Yeah, no, for real.
Because I start to speed things up and I go faster through the timeline at parts because it's just so much. This man, when he finally goes to trial, has 79 counts.
Jesus.
There's so many chances this man could have just, like,
stopped. Right.
In April of 1921, Peter was released again, and this time he went to go live with his sister in Altenburg. I read somewhere that it's partially because he told his sister that he was a prisoner of war this whole time and not, like, in prison. So she felt really bad for him. And she's like, I can't believe you went through all this. You must be, like, really messed up. Why don't you come here and let me take care of you? Mm-hmm. Like, you need help, clearly. Mm-hmm. And this was not the sister that he did the horrifying acts to. This was a different sister.
I would hope.
So Peter's 38 years old at this point, and his sister then introduces him to one of her friends who's 41 years old, named Augusta Scharf. And this woman owns a local candy store. And again, Peter's sister thinks, like, oh my God, he's just went through all this. Maybe I'll set him up. Maybe I'll do something nice for him.
Right.
Now, funny thing, she sets him up with Augusta. Augusta has her own troubled past, actually. So she was a former prostitute, and she was previously convicted of shooting her former lover.
Oh, so they're great for each other.
Yes. Augusta had shot and killed the local gardener who was her ex-lover. And that happened in 1911, whom this guy she dated between, like, 5 to 8 years. He was apparently married the whole time they were dating, but he kept promising to leave his wife for Augusta.
Right, because that always happens.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, eventually he backed out on that and told Augusta he's not going to leave his wife. And instead, he's going to leave Augusta. Well, after that, she was really upset. So she went, she found a gun, and then she just shot him. He did not die. So,
oh, my gosh.
Again, reasons her and Peter work out great.
Right.
So he went to authorities and told them what happened. And authorities obviously get her right away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she ends up serving 5 years in prison for this. Well, then she moves later and she opens up this candy shop, and then she becomes best friends with Peter's sister. And then Peter's sister is like, hey, I got a guy for you.
So here we are.
And here we are. Now Augusta and Peter are, like,
perfect,
dating.
Right. Perfect match.
After 2 years of dating, Peter and Augusta end up getting married. And from an outsider perspective, life seems really normal for Peter because he started to get a steady job. He had a wife who had a steady job. Things were changing. They had their own place. Things were turning around. Like, some stories paint this couple as the normal life. But then a lot of people were like, Peter was really violent. He was sexually aggressive, and he was, like, awful to Augusta, to the point where, like, apparently one time he made a comment about, like, either breaking her ribs or stabbing her ribs if she wouldn't have sex with him or something like that. Or, like, another time, like, something about, like, are we going to get married? And she's like, I don't know. And he's like, do it or I'll kill you. Like, things like that. Like, this is a very aggressively charged relationship. There is no happiness in this relationship. It is purely, like, fear of each other almost. And just, like, they're not together for love. I will say that.
Right.
In 1925, Peter and his wife, Augusta, returned to Dusseldorf. Peter said, Dusseldorf is one of my favorite words. I just gotta say.
Dusseldorf.
Dusseldorf?
It's just fun to say.
Dusseldorf. Peter said returning there was almost like the city was just luring him in, calling to him. Instantly when he returned, he started up affairs, though. He also started raping women, and then he committed 30 more cases of arson. There was a story about this woman named Maria. So Peter met her, and when he tried to seduce her, she obviously declined him, and so she screamed, and Peter strangled her.
Sounds about right.
Yep, and then he fled the area. She didn't die, and she didn't report this to the authorities because she didn't want anyone thinking she was, like, promiscuous, I guess, or, like a harlot. She didn't want anyone getting the wrong impression of her, which back then, you know, like, if they would have blamed it on her.
It happens quickly, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then, at the same time, guess what else he's doing? He's having all these affairs. So one affair that Peter was said to have at the time was with this housekeeper named Tita. Peter would strangle Tita during sexual events and tell her that that was normal and that's what being in love feels like. Tita was not the only woman that Peter was having an affair with, though. There was also Mac. Mac, much like Tita, felt that Peter was really violent, and he also would always gaslight her into telling her that this violence was normal behavior of relationships and love. In 1927, Augusta found out about some of the affairs, and she was really upset, and she went as far as to kick Peter out of the home.
Damn, she should have shot him. Come on, Augusta, why didn't you shoot him? Your gun?
Like, that would have solved so many things. End of the episode, Augusta shoots Peter.
Yep.
And then Augusta goes on to live with Tita and Mac, and they're this dynamic trio women singer band.
Yes, perfect.
When Tita found out that Peter was kicked out, she realized that Peter was probably married to the woman he was living with.
No kidding.
Because up to that point, she wasn't aware of that. Like, I don't know if she thought that Augusta maybe was like his sister, or if maybe he told her they were separated, but they were still living together, or maybe they were just roommates. But she was like, something's up.
Well, it's a different time frame. So, yeah,
and they don't have kids or anything. So who knows, you know, like what he was getting away with. Tita had reported Peter to authorities at this point. And at that time, unlawful seduction or seducing someone else while you were married is considered a crime against society. So meanwhile, Mac also came forward telling authorities about how Peter had also raped her at one point. Peter ended up with both of his affairs ending him in an 8-month prison stay for seduction and threatening behavior. And meanwhile, the whole time he kept pleading his innocence. Peter was released 2 months early under the condition that he leaves Dusseldorf.
Thank you.
Peter will overturn this condition and return to the area, though.
Of course.
But yeah, that would have been a good one. While Peter was put away, Peter kept writing to his wife repeatedly saying he was a changed man and things were different now. He had learned his lesson. Mm-hmm. Well, Augusta sadly believed these tales, and she wanted nothing more than to try to have a pleasant life with a pleasant husband. So she hoped for the best and she stuck it out with Peter. She also was not fully aware of everything Peter was doing and what he was capable of because,
I mean, I would hope so.
Like, at this point, I don't think that she knew about the arson, the bestiality, the raping of his sister, like all this other random stuff, the killing of people and stuff. She just thinks like, damn, my husband cheated on me.
Yeah.
Like, that's all she's thinking is like, that sucks, but he cheated on me. And she's kind of, I'm a little bit inserting my opinion here, but she's probably thinking like, I blamed my husband for cheating. I kicked him out. And then these two women probably were like pissed that he broke up with them. So they went and told authorities, whatever, to like get back at him.
Yeah.
He probably didn't rape them. He probably didn't be mean to them. Even though he's doing that to her, she's probably like, oh, he wouldn't do that to them. Because that's kind of how a victim mindset goes. Mm-hmm. You think that you're the problem, not that anyone could be the problem. You think you are.
Right.
So I feel like she probably genuinely was like, mm. And also at this point, he probably had beaten her down a lot. So coming, like, she probably didn't think she could get that many other people or something, or like that her life was different. So coming back to him seemed like the easier solution.
Right.
On February 3rd, 1929, Peter, who was now 46 years old, had a thirst for killing someone again. He didn't care who it was, but he decided that would be the day. He stalked a middle-aged woman named Maria Kuhn. Peter had waited till no one could see. He hid in some bushes before jumping out and attacking her. He grabbed her by the lapels of her coat, covered her mouth to omit her screams, and then drug her in a nearby bush before stabbing her 24 times with a pair of sharpened scissors he had in his pocket. These stabs were so deep that most of them went all the way down to her bones. However, she will survive. Peter struck again only days later on February 8th. He abducted an 8-year-old girl named Rosa Oliger, and she was playing in her front yard alone. So he just grabbed her, covered her mouth, and strangled her before stabbing her in the stomach, her temple, her genitals, and heart with the scissors 13 times.
There's that number again.
Sorry. Peter then drank the blood from the wound in Rose's temple before becoming so aroused that it made him ejaculate again. He then inserted his semen into her vagina with his fingertips.
Nope. Nope. Nope.
It didn't stop there. Peter drug Rose's body into some nearby bushes to try and hide her body before leaving. He then just left and went to the movies like a normal day. But then hours later, he came back and returned to her body with some kerosene to set the evidence of his crime ablaze. Meanwhile, orgasming at the sight of her burning body.
See, that's, you know,
a burning child body, an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
That he violently did this to.
Definitely not making light of that, but I still think that he was probably definitely doing all of those things when he was committing the arson.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was all just one big happy family of that.
It was late at night and Peter was nervous at this first time trying to burn the body that it would cause a scene. So instead, he actually decided to wait the next day. But the next morning when he did it, he goes to burn her body and he stands across the street and watches it. A few hours later, some construction workers find her burned, charred body. Victim number three was number three at this time period. Mind you, I'm not counting the childhood murders.
The others, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not counting the assaults and attacks. I'm counting just the murders at this point. Or actually, I'm just counting this week's attacks. Mm-hmm. That's so fucked. Victim number three was February 13th, a 45-year-old mechanic named Rudolph Shear. Peter stabbed the man 20 times in the head, specifically in the temples is where he would stab people in the head, which is like a very thick bone area.
Yeah.
He would stab them in the head, in the back, and in the eyes with the scissors. Peter then drank some of the blood, got himself off again at that, and then left the crime scene. Similar to the tavern incident from Catherine, he returned to the crime scene. And this time, though, he went as far as to walk up to the authorities and talk to them about the murder. He said that someone had called him about the grisly case, and he started giving some information about what he thought about the case to one of the detectives.
Interesting.
That's like a very common thing with serial killers.
Yeah, because they want to know. Like,
they want to know if you're onto them, but they also want to, like, insert themselves into the case.
Yeah.
That's why a lot of times they'll look very closely at the people that are nearby or in the case.
Yeah.
None of the three victims were really closely linked, and they all differed in age, sex, and even race, so it made things more difficult at first for authorities to try to link stuff together. The only thing that was the same at each point during these crimes was that they happened in Dusseldorf, and they all happened near dusk, and that each victim was stabbed a multitude of times by what looked like it could have been the same weapon. Each victim was stabbed in the temple. Each victim also looked like they were part of what could have been a robbery gone wrong. Instead of instantly finding a new victim, Peter did have a somewhat of a small cooling down period, and he turned his focus elsewhere during the next few months following the murders. So from March to July, Peter attempted to just strangle women.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no big deal.
He strangled four women. And then in August, he resumed stuff. In August 14th, Peter went to the Dusseldorf Zoo, which for someone that is very into bestiality, I feel like that's not someplace you should go. But he went there and he met a worker named Maria Hahn. Peter asked her out and they made plans for the following day to go on a date. Peter then takes her out for, I think, drinks and dinner. And then afterwards, they go for a walk where Peter led Maria into a clearing where he knew that he could get away with doing what he's about to do. Peter strangled Maria till she passed out. And then once she came to it, he strangled her again till she passed out. Then afterwards, Peter stabbed her in the throat with the scissors where he drank her blood until he vomited. And Peter would stab his victims in a specific way where he would almost like prick them and let the blood kind of like shoot out so that he could like put his mouth to it and drink it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Maria didn't die from this injury of being stabbed and drinking the blood. And so Peter said Maria started begging and pleading for her life, but Peter didn't show her any remorse. Instead, he began stabbing her in the stomach, head, temples, neck, and chest until she died again.
Right.
Peter then disposes of her body in a small ditch under some twigs and dirt that he put together. This time around, Peter made the mistake that he hadn't done before. He was a little bit more careless. He ended up actually getting a little bit of blood on his clothes, which made his wife question him. Because something about Peter is he's always dressed very fancy, like full done suit almost every single day, including when he does his crimes. Well, this time he accidentally got a little blood on him. So he, you know, knows that his wife's going to question him. He decided he needed to hide Maria's body more because now he got questioned by his wife and he didn't want to have to deal with essentially what's going to happen if a body gets found after his wife found blood on him and stuff. So Peter goes back to Maria's body and then buries it in a cornfield this time instead. A few weeks later, Peter makes the decision that he wants to dig up Maria's body and nail it up in a tree in a mock crucifixion style to like really shock people. But he's unable to do that in the end because he wasn't strong enough to lift her. So at this point, instead, he just caresses and cuddles with her deceased body before burying her again.
Don't like that.
I'm going to flip forward and then flip backwards for a second. In November, he will end up bringing Maria up again because he will send the location of her body in a letter to newspapers and say that she was murdered by the vampire of Dusseldorf. Because around this time, there's this other guy who actually gets put away for potentially being the vampire of Dusseldorf because this other guy strangles two women and he ends up getting blamed with it because he's in Dusseldorf area and he strangles two women. What the fuck's happening in Dusseldorf?
Right. I don't want to go. Like, yeah. I'm never going.
Fucking Dusseldorf, man. Well, so then when the authorities get this other guy, they're like, are you the vampire of Dusseldorf? And they're like, tell us the stories. That guy just kind of happened to guess and get a lot of the details correct.
Mm.
And so he ends up like essentially getting blamed. But he also is like kind of stoked. He confesses to being like, yeah, I'm the killer. Well, at first, Peter is a little stoked about that because he's like, cool, I'm off the hook. But then he's like, wait.
This is my work.
You confessed and you took the blame, but also you took the credit for my work. Like, that's such a thin line for killers. Like, taking the blame's good, but taking the credit's not, which that's gross because, like, taking the blame, like, that means, like, you're pushing it off. But saying you're taking the credit for murdering someone is such a disgusting, like, way to think about it.
Yep.
So this upset Peter. And so Peter decides to, in November, use these letters to kind of throw it in the authorities' faces, being like, ha ha, I'm actually the vampire of Dusseldorf and you didn't catch me. You put the wrong man behind bars. Ha ha, fuck you. But since he didn't send those letters until November, he's really busy up until the Maria Hahn murder, until the newspaper confession. So let's talk about what he did there. And then, you know, all right, let's rewind again. After murdering Maria Hahn, Peter starts to lose his passion for stabbing people with scissors. So he moves on to using a knife. So authorities wonder if this was to try and convince them that there was more than one serial killer on the loose. It kind of works that way. And he kind of like says like, yeah, I meant to do that.
Right.
Because now they're like, oh, this isn't the same person. This is a whole new weapon. Maybe there's two people doing it. On August 21st, he stabs an 18-year-old girl. He stabbed her in the back. Then he stabs a 30-year-old drunken man that he also stabbed in the back. And then he's just like walking down the street. And he stabs a 37-year-old woman in the ribs while walking next to her. Just like a quick stab walk. Joop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All three of these people were seriously wounded and they all stated to the police. Their assailant did not speak to them. The guy just attacked them and walked away.
Literally just doop.
On August 24th, Peter then followed two foster sisters, age 5 and 14 to their home from the fairgrounds. The older girl, Louise Lindzen, agreed to help Peter by running to the store to pick him up some cigarettes in exchange for some money. And Peter was like, oh, I'll watch your little sister, foster sister, Gertrude Hammaker. I'll watch her for you while you run to the store. And he agreed to give Louise some money for this. So that's probably why she was like willing to do this, because, you know, like as a kid, you don't think that far in advance type thing is the best way I'll say it. When Louise leaves, Peter attacks Gertrude, the younger girl. She's 5 years old. Her name's Gertrude Hammaker, and he strangles her and then cuts her throat before tossing her body under some bushes in the garden. Louise then comes home and sees her murdered sister and tries to run away and escape, but she wasn't fast enough. Peter strangles her as well, stabs her in the aorta, bites her throat, cuts her throat, and then begins sucking the blood from her wounds. The reason why they say that they think Louise tried to run is because they saw the pattern of her footprints and it looked like she tried to get a few steps in. And that's why they think she tried to run. Next, Peter attacks 27-year-old Gertrude Schultz after making advances towards her and asking her to have sex with him. When she declines his advances, Peter attacks her while stabbing her in the head, in the temples, in the neck, in the shoulders, and the back. He stabs her in the back so hard it snapped the blade of the knife. She survives.
What?
And ends up talking. Yeah.
Dang.
She survives and ends up talking to authorities, giving the description of her attacker as this: a pleasant looking male around 40 years old. But I cannot remember anything else.
I mean, that's fair.
Like, she's probably so traumatized.
Right.
So now he can't use his knife, right? So next, Peter attacked a girl named Sophie Ruckel. She was a child that was just riding her bike, and he literally snatched her off the bike and attacked her. But she doesn't die.
Okay.
Next is Maria Gadouche, where she was attacked in the middle of the night. And people said they heard Maria screaming, so they came to help, and they ended up chasing her attacker, but they didn't catch it. And that person was Peter. And after these two attacks, Peter decides he's getting a little sloppy and his attacks are taking too long. So he needs to get a faster weapon that will do the job quicker. So he switches to using a hammer for his attacks. I don't know what it is about hammers, but I have a really big fear of getting bludgeoned with a hammer. Like, it just sounds
getting bludgeoned at all. Honestly,
so painful.
But yeah,
because it's just like blunt. I can't imagine that pain.
Well, so. You think about it, like when you accidentally hit your hand instead of the nail.
That's exactly why I was thinking of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm getting that to the side of my head or like my shoulder or something. And, you know, when you get hit so hard, it kind of sends like a vibration of shock through your body. Mm-hmm. And it like almost makes you feel cold for the minute because it's just like such a like your body's in shock.
Yeah.
I could not imagine that repeatedly happening.
Nope.
Mm-mm. Goodness.
Goodness gracious.
I felt like a grandma. And then I like tucked in my little blankie after I said goodness. Right. If you didn't see gracious. I was like, goodness. And I tucked myself in to feel better. Ooh. September 30th, Peter attacks 31-year-old Ida Reuter after meeting at the Dusseldorf station. He convinces her to go off and grab a coffee. So once they leave together, they go to a local cafe, and then Peter and Ida go for a walk near the river where he eventually will attack her. Peter strikes her in the head on both sides with the hammer. He then rapes her and then beats her some more with the hammer and leaves her for dead.
How is that faster?
Your
logic
wrong.
Is stupid.
So Ida ends up surviving this.
Oh, okay.
For a bit. So she ends up being found the next morning at 6:30 a.m. She's in a coma, but she actually does die 24 hours after that.
Mm.
In October of that same year, Peter attacks a woman named Elizabeth Dorier, who is battered to death. Then two other women named Mirror and Wanders, who were both attacked with a hammer, but both women survive. Neither were able to give a description of their attacker or narrow the list of suspects at all. On November 7th, 1929, Peter attacks again. This time he came across a 5-year-old child named Gertrude Alberman, another Gertrude.
Mm-hmm.
He convinces the child to come with him, and then he strangles her before stabbing her in the head with some scissors again.
Don't talk to strangers.
Genuinely.
Talking to them is, I guess, fine in this situation, but don't go with them. Be like, no, bro, I'm gonna stay right here.
The reason he reverted back to the scissors is because in October, when he attacked those two women, the second attack, when he slammed the hammer into the woman, he broke the hammer. So now he had to go back again and get his trusty original weapon, since all of his other weapons keep breaking. So, you know, he had to go back to the scissors, which when you see these scissors, they are horrific looking.
Yeah.
Her scissors from the 1900s are just terrifying looking. Gertrude fell to the ground and Peter stabbed her 34 more times in the head and chest before placing her body against a wall to leave. The media dubbed this serial killer that had been going around Dusseldorf lately and viciously murdering victims, the Vampire of Dusseldorf. It was gaining traction and the horrors continued. Authorities were baffled by the diversity of the victims, since they differed in age, race, gender, and any other factor they could possibly think of. And because there were so many different factors in this case, and different weapons and everything else, like between scissors, hammer, knives, everything, police thought that potentially more than one victim could have been linked to the crimes at some point. The media coverage had sent people into a panic and a frenzy at this point, and meanwhile, Peter's just happy knowing that he's no closer to being caught.
Yeah, I mean, like,
literally not
it's
close
only
at all.
In this one, I don't know how big the town is, I guess, but
like Dusseldorf is.
Yeah, but like how, like, is it like a city? Is it mm-hmm. big? Like, you know what I mean?
Dusseldorf is the second largest city in the area after Cologne. It's the seventh largest city in all of Germany. It has a 600,000 people population.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not a small town.
So Dusseldorf is big. But that would be like, okay, let's say like Chicago.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it's still, when you hear of this many people getting attacked in the streets of Chicago, you hear about it.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you hear about it.
Yeah.
By the end of 1929, Dusseldorf police had received more than 13,000 letters to the public, from the public, sorry. Every single lead was investigated. They had to have help from other police forces in the area because the Dusseldorf authorities couldn't do it alone. Due to all the potential leads, they had over 9,000 individuals who were interviewed and questioned.
Wow.
There were 3,000 clues that were looked into, and 900,000 names were compiled as potential leads. On November 9th, only 2 days after Gertrude was murdered, a local newspaper had received a map revealing the location of her grave. Peter had confessed. He didn't say it was him, but he confessed, saying that the Dusseldorf vampire murdered her, along with a hand-drawn map to where to find her remains. The police use this and they recover Maria Hahn's body and Gertrude's body at these two spots and use these to give proper burials. Because at this point now, they've received both these letters and they've gotten both bodies. Peter, at this point, had loved the mass hysteria that was forming around his infamy.
Of course.
But he does take another bit of a cool down following this murder. Supposedly, from November to February, he doesn't do anything. In February of 1930, Peter begins a series of attacks that are vicious assaults, but none end in death, luckily. On May 14th, 1930, Peter attacks. This time, it was 20-year-old Maria Budlick. Maria got off a train at the Dusseldorf station where a kind man offered to show her to the local hostel. Along the way, Maria noticed the man was taking her in a way that seemed really odd. And they were headed through this park that seemed really empty, and that started to worry Maria. So she starts arguing with this man, and this other man comes up and asks her if she's okay. So Maria tells the new guy that walked up to her that she's feeling really uncomfortable because the first guy's arguing with her and being rude. So the original guy's like, whatever, I'm done. And he just leaves and leaves her in the park. Now she's left alone with the new guy that walked up, and he's like, oh, I'm really sorry. My name's Peter.
Damn it.
Would you like me to help you?
Of course.
Talk about the worst fucking luck in the world.
Right? Like, stay with that other guy.
Who knows who the other guy was, but I feel like he's better than Peter, no matter who he is.
Right.
So Peter asks if she just needs to calm down from the fight by either grabbing a drink or like coming back to his apartment. He gave her his address. He's like, do you just want to like come and relax? Maria was really nervous that Peter was trying to make a move on her. She quickly turns him down and hopes that he understands she's really just wanting to relax after feeling this stressed. Peter understood. He agreed to show her where the hostel is. Instead, Peter doesn't take her to the hostel.
Right.
He lures her into a woods and then strangles her and rapes her. When Maria begins screaming, Peter lets her go and just lets her go free. At one point, Maria says that she told Peter she doesn't remember his name or where he lives and that she doesn't know anything. Maria didn't go to authorities about the incident, so she instead wrote a letter to her friend. Now, supposedly, she ended up being so frazzled she wrote the wrong address on the letter. And on May 19th, after the letter wasn't delivered, a post office clerk ends up opening it to see if it was something important. And they read this letter, and upon seeing it, they were like, that's crazy. So they took it to the authorities. They took it to Chief Gannett, who then brought in Maria for questioning to see if she's the same person, or to see if the person that attacked her is the same serial killer that's currently attacking everyone else. Maria was able to describe her attacker, and then she even took the police all the way to Peter's address. There, they met Peter's landlady, who gave them the name of who was renting that place, Peter Curtin. So Maria ended up being a really big part of Peter's downfall, luckily. And actually, in the episode right before this, Kylie discusses the concept of like someone's wife being their kryptonite. Mm-hmm. And I discuss the concept of how your home life can be different than your outside life. And that's kind of true for Peter, except it's a little different. So like Peter does have a different life with his wife, but he is just as aggressive to his wife. But his wife doesn't know that he's aggressive outside of his wife. She thinks that she's the only one receiving it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit different. But also, Peter eventually does tell his wife things.
Hmm.
So the day that the authorities came to Peter's apartment, he had actually seen them like coming up to the house. So he knew, and he saw Maria. So he knew that he was going to get charged with the connection of raping Maria. So he decides he's just going to spill the beans. So he was nervous that he was going to sometime get caught soon for at least the Maria thing, if not everything. So he decided to tell his wife the truth about raping Maria. He figured this way, then he could be like, yeah, they might try to put more things on me because of my past, but it's not me that did them. It's just, you know, how they think of me. After this, Peter, after he told his wife, Peter left and didn't return home for several days. Now, some sources say Peter was trying to create a plan to set his wife up for some sort of stability and safety in case the authorities took him away, because he did care about her. Other people say he didn't care. And that when he actually told his wife, that he was mad at his wife because she's like, I can't believe you did that. And he's like, I can't believe you're mad at me for doing that.
Okay.
Which he does do that again when he tells her the truth. So when he returns home, he confesses his wife, by the way, I'm also the Dusseldorf vampire.
Oh, yeah. No big deal.
And he does it like that. He's super nonchalant about it. He just kind of like,
by the way.
Yeah. Like says it in conversation, and he details all the killings and attacks to her. And then she's irritated that he's the Dusseldorf vampire, and he's mad at her for being mad at him. He's like, I can't believe you're mad at me for this. Like, why are you mad? Like, he's like gaslighting her.
Right.
Like, guess I shouldn't have told you, babe. Sorry you're angry. Jeez.
I would not be angry in that situation, though, either.
I just won't tell you things from now on.
Right. Like any other couple.
He's so, like, I don't even know how to describe
Peter. He's naive to his actual, like, actions. He doesn't actually understand. Yeah.
On May 24th, 1930, his wife ends up telling authorities that she knew where Peter would be and how to capture him, because she and her husband decided that they would have a rendezvous site. And he pretty much told her, like, if you can't trust me, love me, and be with me anymore, like, here's where I'll be. If you want to turn me in, you can. And if not, you don't have to. So the very next day, she turns him in. And Peter surrenders at gunpoint, and he mentions at one point, he's like, I can't believe you turned me in less than a day later. Like, he's upset at her.
Are you kidding?
Once
you're lucky she didn't shoot you.
Honestly, does he not remember who she is?
Seriously, though.
Once under the original man that she was with did not do near as much as Peter did, and she shot that man.
Right.
Peter. You're married to Peter Curtin,
right?
My woman. So once under arrest, Peter provided an astonishingly detailed account of his strings of crime. And they said that he had an almost photographic memory while describing things. Peter claimed 79 individual acts of crimes and went at great lengths to convince authorities that he did all of them and all of his guilt. He recounted every single thing. And a professor, Carl Berg, who was a psychologist, was there and later published the confessions in a book entitled The Sadist.
No kidding, though. Ugh.
Peter's trial commenced on April 13th, 1931. He had charges of 9 murders and 7 attempted murders. And during the trial, Peter retracted his confession. He came well-dressed in a super, like, good-looking tailored suit and acted like a professional businessman, which actually made everyone super weirded out, because they were like, he looks so normal.
He looks so not this crazy, insane person. Yeah.
Now, at this point, Peter claimed he only confessed in order to ensure that his wife would have financial security. So that's where we get that, like, thought process.
Mm.
However, after some extensive questioning and examinations by the magistrate and a damning amount of evidence and lots of interrogation, Peter readmits that he's guilty. During his trial, a special shoulder-high cage had been built inside the courtroom to prevent his escape. And behind it, they arranged some grisly exhibits of what they called, like, the Curtin Museum. They laid the skulls of his victims, some body parts displaying the injuries that he inflicted. They had everything presented in chronological fashion, including knives, ropes, scissors, and the hammer that were all on show, like even the broken parts. They had articles of clothing. They had the spade he used to bury one of the women. They had everything. And then they had him in a fucking cage, like right there in the courtroom.
He would have liked that, though.
But they did it because they wanted to show everyone how much of a monster he was. Like, they have to keep him behind bars even here.
Oh, okay.
Then when they were describing Peter's crimes, when they were describing the details of him, Peter had to try, and the stenographers were getting so disgusted, creeped out, and angry at this.
Mm-hmm.
Peter had to try not to keep becoming aroused and touching himself at the descriptions of horror and sexually gratifying himself every time they were talking about him murdering. Peter ended up claiming that his childhood and the German penal system was actually the ones responsible for releasing his sadistic tendencies. And because of that, he showed no remorse for any of his crimes. The defense team tried numerous times to paint Peter as someone who was insane, but several doctors testified that Peter was perfectly sane in what he had done and he could not go with an insanity plea. During the time of the trial, thousands of people had gathered in the city and were enraged at Peter and just wanted justice. The jury took only 90 minutes to return a verdict of guilty on all accounts, and Peter Curtin was going to be receiving 9 death sentences. his final meal. This is the most German sentence I'm ever going to say. Most German thing. Ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
His final meal was on the evening of July 1st, 1931. It was Wiener Schnitzel, fried potatoes, and a bottle of white wine. He ate the entire thing and asked for a second helping. A Wiener Schnitzel. I've never heard anyone actually eating one.
I need to look it up. I need to know more.
It's like a fried, it kind of looks like a fried cutlet.
Mm-hmm.
I can't describe it more than that. It's a Wiener Schnitzel.
Hold on. Oh.
Not what you expected, right?
Not at all.
Yeah, people expect like a wiener.
Yeah.
No, it has nothing to look like a hot dog or like a bratwurst or any of that. Peter Curtin was executed by guillotine at 6 a.m. on July 2nd, 1931 in Cologne, Germany. Before being executed, he looked over and asked the psychiatrist, because he was walked to the guillotine by a psychiatrist and a priest. And he looked over to the psychiatrist. And this is like really infamous in the serial killer community. True crime community. I don't want to call it serial killer. Sorry. He said, "Tell me, after my head has been chopped off, will I still be able to hear, at least for a moment, the sound of my own blood gushing from the stump of my neck?"
Oh my God.
So the doctor like replied saying something like, "Yeah, like your ears and brain probably will function for a few seconds after, you know, the blade hits you." So he says, "That would be the pleasure to end all pleasures."
That's fitting. Ejaculate off of yourself.
So then they asked, did he have any last words? And he didn't. After his execution, doctors decided to open Peter Curtin's head to see what was wrong with him, because they thought his behavior was so disturbing. His brain had to have some physical differential, like derailment and like something from the average person. It didn't. Hmm. His head ended up being mummified, then bisected to get to the brain. So it's snapped. It's cut down the middle. Mm-hmm. You know, there was an anatomical study of Peter's brain and they found nothing out of the ordinary. After World War II, Peter's head was transported to the United States and it became part of the personal collection of a man named Arne Coward, an antique dealer in Waikiki. This dude has a morbid sense of humor.
No kidding.
Like, no,
bro. I got
Arne Coward is a weird dude and he has a weird collection. We got to talk about this for a minute. This is not done.
Okay.
Coward was imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp in his homeland of Norway. And after that, he became really obsessed with torture, like really obsessed. Mm. So he started buying torture instruments and he had his own museum in his house. So in 1946, he bought his first thing. He bought a pair of thumb screws. If you don't know what they are, look them up, but you're not going to like it. Mm-hmm. Then Coward's collection started including things like beheading swords, tongue terrors, shrunken heads, chainmail gloves that used to burn hands, a bone crushing wheel, and so many other things. He kept all these artifacts in his home in Hawaii, but then he started displaying some of them in the Waikiki Antique Shop. Later, he opened his own Museum Macabre to show off what he considered the world's most extensive collection of historical torture devices. Now, Coward ended up dying in 1979, so his collection got auctioned off. Where did the head go, right? Well, Ripley's ended up buying the head from the estate in 1989 and added it to the auditorium. So in May of 1990, it acquired its own display at Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum in Wisconsin Dells.
Dales.
Got too excited there. In Wisconsin Dells, Wisconsin. In the museum. Are you ready to know what it looks like?
Yeah, I'm ready.
They have his head hanging on a hook behind a guillotine with a sign that just describes Peter and a short list of who he is and what his crimes were.
I love that.
Behind a guillotine.
I love it.
Have you ever been to a Ripley's?
Yes.
Which one did you go to?
Florida.
Which one?
Orlando.
Oh.
I love it. I love it.
I went to the Hollywood one. It's so fucking cool. I just today messaged Margie and I said, did you know that there's three Ripley's that are like 5 to 6 hours away from us? However, the Wisconsin Dells one is only like 6 hours away and the Dells are just like a cool place. But the Gatlinburg, Tennessee one is supposed to be one of the coolest Ripley's, believe it or not. It's one of the biggest and it's only 9 hours away. And also there is a Holocaust Museum, a Nazi museum, not Nazi, like a World War II like museum. There's also a Titanic museum, and there's like just like a really big museum in Gatlinburg, and Gatlinburg has everything and it has a lot of really good restaurants. And I said, Gatlinburg is only 9 hours away. And I said, I'm not saying we need to go to Gatlinburg. However, dot, dot, dot. And she said, do you want to go to Gatlinburg? And I said, I really fucking want to go to Gatlinburg.
I love museums.
So I'm just telling the world now, if y'all see me posting up at Gatlinburg, you know why. It's because I'm trying to talk anyone into taking me to Gatlinburg. That's all.
Let's do it.
So that's the end of that. Is that not insane?
It's insane.
I kind of like where it ended on, though, because that's a really fucking cool ending.
Yeah.
But when it comes to all of this and like when it comes to Peter, like, holy shit.
Yeah. Shiro has something to say about it.
Shiro is so upset. He's like, I feel the same way, bitch. No, like Peter Curtin is a genuine monster.
Literal.
That's why I brought up in the beginning the whole nurture versus nature versus everything, because there's a lot of things where like, I wonder if he did have a normal childhood. I wonder if he wasn't so poverty stricken and he had more like advances and stuff. I wonder if his dad wasn't like that. I wonder if, you know, he wasn't brought up to know such violence, if he would have sought out, like, because maybe if he didn't see such violence at a young age when he befriended the dog catcher, if he would have been like, hey, this is kind of fucked up what you're doing, I don't like this, and he wouldn't have wanted to see it, you know what I mean? And like, I wonder if there could have been a different snowball effect of good things happening in his life rather than this. Or I wonder if this is just who he was, because he did want to test weird things. He did have a lot of like things where he just kept wanting to up the ante. And I've brought this up multiple times, especially lately, like once you have that little bit, you keep wanting to up it and up it, and you feel like you need to top your own self.
Yeah, get
and
better,
it just
better.
Becomes like this huge problematic ripple effect. And so, you know, I don't really know, but I do know that Peter's a fucking monster.
Yep.
And you want to know, do you know, did I tell you, do you want to know of all people who suggested this case? Did I tell you?
Mm-mm.
My mother.
Okay.
My mom had heard a few things about this guy and she's like, that's crazy. I want to hear Kylie's opinion because Kylie's so calm. I feel like this one will put her into a frenzy. This one will really put her in a snafu. I need to hear what Kylie has to say. So Kylie, tell my mom and the rest of the CSP listeners, how did this make you feel?
Well, definitely uncomfortable. I'm very uncomfy. But yeah, no, I agree. The nature versus nurture, I think it is a very interesting topic. Like, I mean, I don't know if anything was normal in his life to actually be able to form an opinion on that, because the only thing that he had was just really, really bad people around him at all times. So there was just like no way. There was no chance. Like this guy had no, there's no way. There's no way. That's all he knew. And just like with a dog catcher, like, yeah, you have no idea. And so when you're like, oh, this guy like does this, like this is like a normal thing. Like this is how I'm supposed to act, because like this guy is an adult. Like this is what he does.
But that makes me question something else.
Uh-huh.
Did all of his siblings turn out normal?
It seemed very much like that one sister was normal.
Yeah, which is another weird thing. How did his siblings? I know sometimes it's very different, but it's odd to me when there's nothing wrong with them. And it's just weird to me when some of them end up normal and some don't, when they all went through the same thing.
But they're also, I don't know, like the differences in gender. But if they were like female, they were seeing their mother get raped. And so they were probably more so on the sense of like scared. Well, and
plus, yeah, they went
they're
through
women
that.
In this time frame too, like this time period is weird for women, so like,
and they could have ended up finding a loving husband and being like, oh, this teaches me what could be.
Yes.
So yeah, or I guess that could be said about the men too. They could have you know, like found the right relationship and been like, oh my god, this like, is what
this is normal
love
got it.
Is or it could have went the other way where they find a loving relationship and they make their significant other treat that they treat their significant other like a parent in a sense, and they like do that, which is its own brand of like not good, but it's better than becoming Peter Curran.
Yes. For some reason in my head I think that he's the only guy, like he's the only son, which I don't
he's
think
not. No. I just don't know how many boys and girls there were.
Yeah, but he is the oldest, so he's the firstborn.
And he did get the grunt of it. For sure, he got sexually abused, and so did his sister, the one directly under him.
Yeah.
But then it didn't say if any of the other kids did.
Yeah. So I don't know. So that's also an effect. Like, if they were, like, you know, if he's, like, 9 and the other kid is, like, 1 when this is happening, like, the 1-year-old doesn't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
Or even under 1 is not going to understand the things that are happening. So the 9-year-old's going to understand. The 8-year-old's kind of on that, you know, cusp of understanding, and then
repeatedly seeing it the rest of his life, it doesn't help.
Right.
Even when he tries to move on for something, like he finally finds a significant other, that doesn't help because he finds someone just as crazed as him, and then, you know, like things just didn't work out for him.
Well, and his dad is in prison for what, 8 years?
It was like 3 years.
Oh, okay. Well, still, that's a good amount of time from like being 1 to being 4. So if they were like 1,
and at one
they
point,
didn't
the
see
mom
anything.
Relocates, the mom does move on and
exactly.
stuff. So who knows?
That's what I think.
It was a wild one. This is serial killer cases are hard because you have to jam so much information into one outline, which is very difficult because you want to pay enough respect to each person and everything. Mm-hmm. And it is very difficult doing that. But wow, it was hard focusing in on some of this stuff because his crimes are just, they're
horrific.
He's a monster. Thanks, guys, for being here and listening to this doozy of a case with us this week. Feel free to tell us how you feel. And I'm sorry it was such a doozy of a case.
Yes.
Thank you.
A doozy and Dusseldorf.
A doozy and Dusseldorf.
Thank you for joining us after dark. We can't wait to chat with you next week for another new episode. Sleep tight.
Jesus, Mom. For real. Hey, listener, did you have some feedback about this week's case? Or maybe you want to chat with us. Maybe you even have a suggestion you'd like to throw our way. We're always just a click away. You can easily find all of our socials on Linktree through Cryptic Soup Pod, which is available in our Instagram bio. You can also join the CSP Discord, where we would love to chat with you.
Thank you for joining us this week, and make sure to check out our sources available in the description if you want to dive deeper into this case. Don't forget to show your support and love for CSP by leaving a review and rating wherever you normally listen. Next week, we will be back with a new episode where you can join in on the conversation after dark.
Cryptic Soup Pod is a podcast that contains sensitive material at times. We understand if sometimes the subjects are too much for some of the listeners. We thank each and every one of you for being a member of the community and always supporting us. Thank you for everything, and we'll see you next time. So stay tuned.
Peter Curtin, also known as the Dusseldorf. Welcome to Cryptic Soup. Tonight's case is Peter Curtin, also known as the Dusseldorf. God fucking damn it. What?
Dusseldorf.
Yep. Dusseldorf. Okay.
In 1898, father's Peter. No. Peter's father. I'm so sorry.
Father Peter.
Father Peter.
He's a priest now.